asking the American people to help. We need you. We need you to get your friends, family, neighbors, and coworkers vaccinated. Help them find an appointment. Drive them to the site. Talk to them about why you made the choice for yourself. So many Americans have already stepped up to help get their communities vaccinated. And over the next month, we're going to need you more than ever.
President Joe Biden today unveiling new steps the White House is taking to get 70% of American adults at least partially vaccinated by July 4th. It's a goal the president set early last month, and we're close. At about 62%, with about a month to go. As vaccination rates climb, the U.S. is returning to something that resembles life before the pandemic. But a lot of people who are able to work from home for the last 15 months are still working from home. And employers aren't quite sure how to approach bringing them back, especially now that so many jobs can be done from home, maybe in pajamas. In a recent study from McKinsey, nearly 30% of workers said they would consider switching jobs if their employers mandated coming back to the office full time. Well, joining us now to talk about this is Sadal Neely, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. And I should note that you're also author of the book, because this is relevant to our conversation. The book is called Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. Also joining us is Anne Helen Peterson. She's been writing about remote work on her Substack, and her Substack newsletter is called Culture Study. Anne, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
All right, Sadal and Anne, let's just begin with a personal question. What do you like about working from home? Because I presume both of you are doing so and have done so for, well, most of the year. And Sadal, let's begin with you.
I actually love the ability to reach people far and wide without having to leave my house. It's been extraordinary, the number of places I've traveled in the last 12 months without leaving my house, or should I say 14 months, and the ability to also scale. So being able to talk to 700 people, to 1,000 people all at once, and three times a day. It's impossible to do otherwise. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I just like the ability to be productive. I've been working virtually for parts of my job, because I'm a global work scholar as well, for two decades. So this is quite normal for me.
So when you say that you are talking to 1,000 people three times a day, are you talking about teaching classes?
Teaching classes, speaking, whatever it may be. So I'm not saying I'm talking to thousands of people daily. What I'm saying is that this remote work context and the ability to use these digital tools enables me to reach people far and wide in ways that I never could.
Interesting. But I guess you could have, you just didn't. I mean, all of us could have done this, but we just didn't. And I guess that's why we're having this conversation, because now we're reimagining something for the future that doesn't look like what it was pre-pandemic. And what do you like about working from home?
So in my previous life, I was an academic and a professor, and I think academics have had a taste of this sort of flexible work, remote work for a while. And when I moved into journalism, I also had a lot of that same flexibility built into my schedule of, you know, sometimes I would be on the ground reporting, sometimes I would be in transit, sometimes I'd want to work from home and just concentrate on writing for a day. And it was easy for me to do that, especially when I moved from New York to Montana, where I currently live, which is part of what inspired me to actually want to write about and think about remote work right now, is that I had seen the ease and the ability to do so, and how it's great to do things like, oh, on a Friday, I guess I don't have as many things on my plate. And instead of just sitting in my office chair and kind of running the clock out, I can either go outside and hike and do whatever I want to do, or I can run some errands. I can be with my family. You know, there's just so many different things that we can do when the work is not actually there.
Yeah, I know. But that can also be a burden too, right? There are all sorts of home chores that beckon, you know, during the workday. So you, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, I like it though, because I think in other scenarios, times when I was working a much more traditional 9 to 5, which was actually a much more traditional 8 to 6 or 7, you would come home and all of those chores would be there still, right? You still had to do them, but you had a delimited number of hours to perform them. And if you didn't, then your weekend was spent doing these household things. So instead, I can kind of disperse these things that need to happen in my home throughout the day, and they feel less, much less like the second job that I'm doing at all times.
That is a really good point. On the other hand, Sadala, I'd love for you to address this part of it. There's also the reverse of that, where you don't stop working on the weekend.
I call that hyperproductivity, when productivity goes wrong and we blur our work and non-work lives to the point where we're burning out, stressing out, and getting overwhelmed. In the last year plus, we've seen people actually work up to 6.8 hours longer because they're replacing some of the commute times with additional work. And also there's a ton of skills that we need to develop, the type that Anne actually mentions, that allows us to set boundaries and to really segment the day in a way that's productive, as opposed to just adding more hours. That's not sustainable. So you're absolutely right.
Okay, so that gets us into the part of the conversation about reimagining what the work world will look like as we sort of head back into the office, maybe tentatively, maybe we rush back in. I don't know. But it seems like a lot of people who have the luxury of working from home don't necessarily want to go back to the way it was, right, Anne?
Oh, yeah. I think most people are very hungry to get back into the office because they are sick of being in their homes all the time. And they also want the novelty of being around coworkers and being in a different space. But I think once that novelty wears off, which will happen in about a week, a month, several months, there's going to be a desire to really have a more hybrid and flexible schedule that works with the rhythms of a person's day and person's week, instead of simply saying like every single person, no matter the type of work that they do, should be going to and from the office at a certain hour every day.
Right. Okay. So Sadal, what happens with that potential tension? Let's say the employer wants their employees to come back into the office, but the employee says, you know, no, I really like this new life that I have for myself. Maybe I'll come back a couple of days a week. How should the employee negotiate that?
You know, the data on this is actually staggering, and up to 87 to 90% of employees who are surveyed across multiple surveys and polls want to retain some kind of flexibility in their work. And of that number, close to 30% want to remain as remote workers permanently. We have changed. Individuals have changed. Organizations have changed. And many that I've even talked to who were completely looking forward to have everyone back and to return to the good old days have been stunned when they survey their people who say, no, we want more flexibility. And if we don't get it, we will quit. So I think at the end of the day, it's going to be an area where we're going to experiment, learn, and iterate over time.
And what about the equity issue in all of this? Because I can imagine that some workers on the lower tier, if you will, won't have as much bargaining power and would be more likely to be required to come into the office. And have you been thinking about that and how to address this equity issue when it comes to redefining the hybrid workplace?
Yeah, you know what? I've actually heard from people who are in those less senior positions who still, when faced with the opportunity or with the mandate to return to the office, are saying, no, thank you, right? If they have worked for the last year and have found themselves, like many people who were able to sustain their work over the last year, in a pretty stable financial position, they're burnt out. They don't want to work for a place that is going to have this sort of rigid ideals about what work is going to look like. There's a lot of opportunity for different types of jobs. You know, like the market, it is a friendly place for people who want to go on the market right now. And as Dr. Neely was saying, I think the power is much more in the hands of the workers than even some executives may understand at this point.
And another part of this is, if people think more broadly about redesigning and reimagining the future of work, they can actually begin to expand a talent pool and hire people who may live in rural parts of the country and still have them be a thriving member of their community. So it's about expanding and thinking about how can we use flexibility not only to empower the people we have, but when we need to hire, we can go beyond where we've been before, add more pipes to the pipeline issues as well.
Yeah, and so thereby, hopefully in an ideal world, increase diversity in this new world.
Precisely.
In terms of the candidates that you can hire.
Yeah. I mean, I talked to a lot of people who were trying to work with various companies on their DE&I, diversity, equity, and inclusivity policies, and they would be so resistant to the idea of remote work. They'd say, you know, we want to embrace DE&I at our company, but we want every single person who works for us to live in downtown Seattle. Right? Like that is just putting a ceiling on the types of people who are going to want to work for you. I think that opening yourself up to different types of hybrid, remote, distributed types of work, it just opens up the candidate pool enormously.
What are the downsides for the employee when he or she works from home or works remotely in terms of benefits and I don't know, like crucial networking opportunities to move up in the company or just even feeling like you belong to something, belong to a group of people and forge bonds, you know, amongst your coworkers? Is there a problem or a danger of feeling isolated and not connected to your workplace and therefore not being, in the eyes of the company, a productive employee?
You can be. But that's if you let the work process unfold organically. Mm-hmm. We know that video conferencing and all these different digital tools have such a powerful convening power so that people can actually meet and connect with others that typically wouldn't be accessible. So for example, top leaders have been more visible to the entire organization through these video conferencing tools more than ever before, because historically top leaders used to fly to select places of the organization. Now everyone can see them on their gallery view. That's incredible.
You know, it's so funny that we had all these tools before and yet we didn't use them. How come?
I mean, I think part of it is that there's just this really interesting idea that somehow if you let workers work autonomously or at home, that they will just nap all day, which right. is not, you know, what happened in any capacity. I think there was just this accepted wisdom that somehow productivity would go down and you wouldn't have control over your workers. And that was proven wrong. You know, sometimes to change the status quo, you need to have a rupture as significant as a pandemic.
I think that's exactly right. And we've changed. Work has changed, which is why I feel so strongly around ensuring that people understand that there's no going backwards. It's all about looking forward and designing workplaces that accommodate not only the best that we can pull from a flexible workforce, but using technologies in intelligent ways to convene, to democratize, to increase our talent pool in ways that we want to, and have people whose job satisfaction is higher and productivity as well. It's all good news.
Saddal Neely teaches at the Harvard Business School and is the author of the book Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. And Anne Helen Peterson writes the Culture Study Substack. She has a forthcoming book called Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, as employers and employees continue to negotiate what the office will look like going forward, one of the big sticking points will likely be whether employers can require staff coming into work to get vaccinated. According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they can. But so far, a lot of companies have resisted, mainly out of fears that it could land them in a big legal fight. Well, here to tell us more about that is Joseph Siner. He's a labor and employment expert and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on the program today.
Well, it's my pleasure. All right. So the EEOC guidance says, yeah, you can do that. It's legal. And why would they say that? Why would they issue this directive? Have there been lots of questions about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been percolating on state level, on the national level. It's something that people have been thinking about even before the vaccine really began to roll out in large numbers, because it's something that you really anticipate. And on top of that, you know, this isn't the first time there's been a vaccine or employers have found the need to require that their employees be vaccinated. So it's something I think that they were anticipating for a while was going to be an issue, and they were correct. It's really something that's forefront on a lot of employees' minds.
And can employers do that even if the vaccines are not authorized for permanent use? Like right now, they're under emergency use authorization.
Yeah, that's actually a superb question. They actually still can do that. There's a little bit of difference there if you're talking about the military, where they're going to need that permanent approval. But with respect to just private employers, they certainly can require, even if it's not for permanent authorization yet.
But if you are a public university, you can't until it's for permanent use, right?
Exactly.
Right. Okay. But so a lot of these companies, though, these private employers are still not doing that. They're not requiring that employees who return to the office or the workplace be vaccinated. Why?
Well, I think that employers really are grappling with that. And it really is a landscape that's been changing so quickly that sometimes it's even hard to get at the forefront of it. But it is a very sensitive both political issue and personal issue. And I think a lot of employers understand an individual's personal choice on this. And many times individuals are making choices not only for themselves, but how they view their community or their families. And so I think a lot of employers really are giving individuals the space to do that, even if you're talking about from a global health standpoint or a state health standpoint, it probably makes sense to at least encourage employees to go ahead and get that vaccination.
Right. Well, would they have to provide accommodations? Like, let's say you had a religious problem with it, or maybe a medical issue that you couldn't get vaccinated, or maybe it's an access issue.
Yeah. And the two primary exceptions that the EEOC talks about are with respect to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which covers disabilities, and Title VII, which deals with accommodations for religious issues or convictions. The truth of the matter is, though, that those are very narrow exceptions, and it would be hard to impose those. But at the same time, there will be circumstances, undoubtedly, where that becomes a concern for employees and where employers will have to accommodate. I do one other thing, too. A lot of times these issues appear really black and white in terms of enforceability. But as an employer, and I know your previous guests were doing a great job talking about the job market right now, do you really want to be terminating employees in these situations, or do you want to just sit down and have a discussion with them as to how you can best work this out? Maybe there is a good reason that somebody for religious or disability purposes can't get the vaccine, or an access issue, as you said. Maybe there are different ways to handle that, or different jobs or positions they can take on in the short term while the pandemic plays itself out.
Another aspect which is kind of fuzzy is inducements versus coercion. So mm-hmm. the EEOC says you can't coerce an employee, right? But you can encourage. And so how do you draw that line between coercion and encouragement? Like, for example, if you say, well, you can work from home, but you can't come into the office unless you're vaccinated, could that be seen as a form of coercion?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly, I mean, I don't know if coercion, employers, we come at this from this backdrop, and 49 states have this rule of employment at will where you can fire somebody for any reason. So certainly an employer can say, you cannot come in the office unless you're vaccinated in the vast majority of circumstances, with those limited, you know, religious or disability potential exceptions. So there's absolutely nothing that would prohibit most employers from taking the opposite standpoint, the incentive, the carrot rather than the stick, and say, I think Kroger's is a great example of that, who they provided, I think, something like $100 gift cards for employees who got vaccinated. And a lot of employers are seeing that as a better way, at least from a practical and a PR standpoint, of encouraging people with benefits to get vaccinated rather than having to deal with these sticky situations of what happens when an employee won't get vaccinated. And that makes, a much more difficult reason for both political a backdrop to, you know, just dealing with employees.
And then could you say, well, yeah, you can come into the office, but you have to wear a mask?
Yes, you absolutely could do that. And you could even be doing that with, as you see in many workplaces now, and I think California's restrictions are being eased back on that, for the next couple of days. But in many private businesses, mm-hmm. they can go ahead and just continue to require that. I just got my hair cut this morning, and, you know, they required I wear a mask as a client.
Yeah.
And the person that was cutting my hair was wearing a mask. So certainly they can continue, and I think will continue to do that to encourage business.
And can they ask employees if they've been vaccinated and to show proof? Is that legal?
Yeah, that's great. And the EEOC actually addresses this in their technical guidance. And they can. This is another really interesting issue of the law where disability and the ADA is one area where you actually cannot ask people certain questions. So you could ask me if I wanted to work for you if I'm 40 years of age or older. It's not a good question, but it's not an illegal question. But medical questions, the questions themselves can be illegal. Here, the EEOC says it's not a medical exam. It's not a medical procedure because you can go to CVS, right, and have somebody just jab your arm. So it's not really medical in nature, which is, maybe pushing the definition of that a little bit.
So you can say, are you vaccinated? You have to tell me.
You can say that. You can also require that they show proof with the vaccination card. If you wanted to do something like a blood test or a little more invasive, that could run into some problems. But certainly asking them to produce a vaccine card, employers absolutely could.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
That's Joseph Siner. He's a professor of law at the University of South Carolina. And we want to hear from you. What is one thing from the pandemic you are taking with you into a post-COVID world? Whatever it is, share it with us at kcrw.com/pressplay, or you can call and leave a message at 424-538-8581, 424-538-8581, and we might use your comment on air. Coming up, lots of ransomware attacks recently. The attackers demand payment in cryptocurrency. So, should that be banned? Can it be banned? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The biggest cyber attack on our nation's infrastructure yet.
Forced the shutdown of a major U.S. pipeline.
Today confirmed that a Russian criminal group is behind the hacking of a crucial energy pipeline.
And tonight we are learning that a ransom was paid to get that gas flowing again.
Last month's cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline created 1970s-style gas lines across the southeastern United States for days. The world's largest meat processor saw its supply chain disrupted by a cyber attack yesterday. And just today, a ransomware attack disrupted ferry service in Massachusetts between Cape Cod, Nantucket, and Martha's Vineyard. Nobody's immune, really. Even here in our backyard in the San Gabriel Valley, the city of Azusa acknowledged Friday that its police department had been the victim of a ransomware attack that it had kept quiet for months. Well, this kind of cybercrime is an international problem, and a lot of these digital hostage takers demand payment in cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, even Dogecoin. We're going to talk about this now with Jacob Goldstein. He's the co-host of NPR's Planet Money podcast, and his latest book is called Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Hi, Jacob. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it is great to have you back. And let me just play one more clip of tape. And this is from Chris Krebs, the former Homeland Security official. He led the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And if you remember the president at the time, Trump famously fired him by tweet for not going along with the big lie. Well, here is what he said, what Chris Krebs said to Congress during a hearing about ransomware attacks last month.
We are on the cusp of a global digital pandemic, driven by greed, a vulnerable digital ecosystem, and an ever-widening criminal enterprise. The underlying enabling factors for this cybercrime explosion are rooted in the digital dumpster fire of our seemingly pathological need to connect everything to the internet.
Okay, so, and he went on to say that cryptocurrency, he did, is fuel on that digital dumpster fire. So, should cryptocurrencies be banned? Like, would that take care of this whole problem?
That is a strong opener. I mean, let me say, you know, I'm a reporter, not a pundit. So, like, should is not so much my
okay,
my
can.
Business.
How about can
yeah,
it be
probably
banned?
Not, right? Like, seems very unlikely. I mean, I guess it's interesting to start a discussion with, like, a radical position, just get rid of it. But by its nature, it's code, right? So, like, you can't, it's like knowledge, right? It's like the knowledge to, you know, well, building the atomic bomb is not the metaphor we want to go for, but you can't remove the knowledge of cryptocurrency from the world. So practically speaking, you could make it harder to use. You couldn't ban it.
You couldn't say, okay, no more mining of it, because the mining, you know, aside from all the problems with ransomware, that's like an energy problem.
I apologize. Yeah, mining is an energy problem. I mean, countries can be more aggressive about regulating it, right? Like China appears to be moving to regulate the mining of cryptocurrency more aggressively. The U.S., particularly at the state level and more at the federal level, has been moving to regulate cryptocurrency exchanges and intermediaries more. So there are meaningful things you can do short of banning it that might be useful.
Okay, so you could regulate it, even though this is by its very nature something that's supposed to be anonymous, that anyone can use it and not be traced, right?
Yes. So, I mean, cash is quite a handy metaphor, right? Cryptocurrency was invented to be digital cash, right? And indeed, cash, and particularly $100 bills, are very useful tools for committing crimes, right? There are an amazing number of hundreds in the world. There are more hundreds than ones. There are something like 30 or 40 hundreds for every man, woman, and child in America. And, you know,
really?
Some of that is used by people outside the U.S. as a store of value. A lot of it is used for crime, right? It's a really convenient way to move large sums of money around anonymously. And we have lots of rules that say, if somebody walks into a bank with $100,000 in hundreds and says, oh, I just want to open a checking account, the bank can't just say, okay, here's your checking account, right? They have to alert the authority. There are anti-money laundering laws and know your customer laws. And these are starting to be applied to these emerging, you know, above board crypto exchanges like Coinbase.
Well, how would that work? Because there is no bank for cryptocurrency.
Right. So it wouldn't work great, right? It wouldn't solve all of the problems. It would work better, I feel like, within the United States, right? Because much of the volume of crypto trading in the U.S. goes through regulated exchanges, right? Exchanges that have said to the government, okay, we're going to sign up for your program. We're going to be on board to, you know, be transparent and follow the law. Now, the problem is, right, these ransomware attacks are largely coming from outside the United States. They are reportedly largely coming from Russia, right? That's the reports today about the latest one is from Russia. And so Obviously, our regulations won't do anything about that. But, you know, there is the level of like diplomacy, right? We know that Biden and Putin are going to be meeting. They say they're going to be talking about this. So, you know, these ransomware attacks seem to be not one guy in a bedroom, right? They seem to be large and coordinated. And the kinds of things that states, nations, if they want to crack down on, make more difficult, they can, even if they can't make them go away altogether.
Unless they secretly or not so secretly want them to flourish.
Right, right. Well, interesting. I was thinking today about this conversation. And, you know, one thing that's striking is because the dollar, the U.S. dollar, is the reserve currency, right? It's basically the money that everybody in the world uses for international transactions, even if neither party is in the United States, right? The standard thing people transact in is the dollar. That gives the United States an extraordinary amount of not just economic power, but essentially political power, hegemonic power, right? It allows the U.S. to impose sanctions that really bite because everybody's trade, you know, if Iran is selling oil to whatever, China, that is usually done in dollars. So we can grab those dollars if we want to impose sanctions. So it does seem like having this sort of crypto ransomware underground might be useful, say, to a Russia if they want to, you know, strike back at that U.S. hegemonic power. But I don't know. I'm kind of outside my expertise there, but it seems like that to me.
Well, it seems like, though, that cryptocurrency is becoming just a much more mainstream. You know, I mean, if you got Elon Musk on Saturday Night Live talking it up, even though he did admit it is a bit of a hustle, then that's pretty mainstream. So are regular people investing in it? And do you envision a time perhaps in the near future where we'll all be using cryptocurrency?
I would say yes and no, respectively, to those two questions, right? I mean, clearly, lots of people are investing in crypto. You know, the guy at my bodega was explaining different kinds of crypto to another guy at the bodega like a week ago. And I don't know if that was a top or a new era, but that was definitely a moment that I noted. It's weird, right? Crypto has been around now for more than 10 years. It's clearly gone mainstream. Everybody sort of knows what it is. It's worth a tremendous amount of money. So yes, everybody, you can buy it. It's not hard to buy. You can buy it on your phone. It's strange to me that it has become so prominent and so valuable and still so rarely used, right? Like, I am open to the possibility that it could be really useful. You know, when workers are sending remittances home, they have to pay high fees, right? Like, by all means, somebody come up with a crypto solution that lets those workers pay lower fees, right? That's great. I just bought a house. I'm gonna have to pay all this money for title insurance. Like, what even is that? Sure, if somebody could put that on the blockchain and save me money, great. And it's weird to me that that hasn't happened yet, right? Like, I hope it will, but it's striking that it hasn't happened yet.
Okay, I hope it will too. And in the meantime, you do have your $100 bills safely stashed away, I hope.
If you need to commit crimes, I'm not saying you should, they're there.
Jacob Goldstein, author of the book Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing. Thank you.
Oh, it was fun. Thanks.
Coming up, why Airbnb prices are way up.
Airbnb users have been piling on complaints on social media about the fees. In some cases, they can cost as much as one night stay.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you went to an airport over the Memorial Day weekend, you probably felt like the pandemic is over. Nearly 2 million people traveled on Friday alone. Compare that to just 300,000 a year ago. And as more people book flights and make travel plans, well, they need somewhere to stay. Hotel rates are rising, with some places in Cancun and Hawaii charging more than they did before the pandemic. Prices are high on Airbnb, too. And now people are complaining that there may be some price gouging going on with all the fees. Joining us to talk about this is Hannah Sampson. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, where she focuses on travel news. Hi.
Hi.
Well, what does it look like? How expensive is it now to rent an Airbnb these days?
Well, part of the problem is that it's hard to say with one statement how much it will be, because it may always be a fun surprise. So right. you're going to look at a map for where you want to go, and you're going to see, 100 different price points. And then the choose your own adventure continues, where you click on one and you'll find out how much of a cleaning fee are they going to charge, how much of a service fee is Airbnb charging, and then what are the taxes. So you'll have multiple different factors, and then you'll have a total. But it can add up to a lot with all of those different fees baked in.
Yeah, some people are saying those fees are costing more than the actual price of the room.
Especially if you're staying for like one night and you say, oh great, it's $100 a night, and then you click and look at it further, then you see another maybe $70 for cleaning and another $40 for service, and then you have double the original price that you saw. So yeah. that has been getting a lot of pushback on social media.
And are the cleaning fees high because of the pandemic? Like the hosts have to scrub everything down, and it just costs a lot of money to make it sanitary?
Well, so there's always been cleaning fees have always been there. Not everyone has charged them to guests, but to make people feel more comfortable about staying in Airbnb, the company did put in place a whole list of mandatory safety practices that say, you have to dust and clean, and then you have to sanitize, and you wipe down all the doorknobs and the sinks and everything, and then you check everything. It's a 5-point process that they said everyone needs to do. So that takes more time. It takes more, cleaning supplies probably. So in that case, it is likely that more hosts felt comfortable or felt necessary to raise the cost of the cleaning fee.
And so is all this making travelers think, I want to go back to going to hotels?
It's funny because that was a lot of the tone of the complaints on Twitter and elsewhere. People are just like, look, I can stay at a hotel. There's somebody at the front desk all the time to bring me towels if I need them. And I don't have to put the dishes in the dishwasher when I leave, which a lot of Airbnb hosts will say, like, oh, please tidy up on your way out. So people are like, why am I paying you $100 cleaning fee and then I'm loading the dishwasher? So yes, in that case, people, many people have said, I might as well just stay in a hotel if that's what's going to be the outcome.
Right. And so these fees are set by the hosts themselves, right? Not Airbnb. So this must be a tough position for Airbnb because they don't want to lose customers. Right.
Sure. And they have mounted a defense of their fees and of their transparency. And they say it is up to the host to set a cleaning fee, and they give advice on how to make it reasonable. And they even say in some cases you don't have to set a cleaning fee at all. Not everybody does either. But they do want to insist that, like, this, don't look at us. This isn't us. They set this themselves, and we try to be transparent. At least before you pay, you know what it's going to cost.
The other part of this is taxes, and that has been a sticky subject for localities and Airbnb, right? Because Airbnb for a long time said, hey, we're just facilitating this. We're not actually a lodging business, kind of like Uber's argument. And cities like here in Los Angeles fought back and said, no, we're losing revenue and taxes from hotels because people are staying in your Airbnbs and not paying taxes. And so did Airbnb finally give in to that, and now that's why the taxes are higher, or there are taxes in the first place?
Right. So you'll see, in addition to those cleaning fees and other fees, you will see then the local taxes that you have to pay. So it's a real patchwork. It's not like in one price that you should expect everywhere you go. Airbnb has kind of worked out these deals with local governments all over the world, really, so that they can then the host can include that amount in what the guests pay. So this is a way to keep Airbnb out of court and out of hot water with local governments, but it is another fee, and it is kind of another complication that people have to consider when they're thinking about booking.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We're having this conversation about how much money and how packed Airbnb is and how much money they're making or the hosts are making, because a year ago today, people were writing off Airbnb and other similar companies as dead because they couldn't see the travel coming back for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, early in the pandemic, everything was cratering. You know, everybody was like, stay home, stop the spread, all the terms that we became so used to. And nobody wanted to risk being exposed to other people's germs or surfaces. Business was very bad. And I would say it was a little more than a year ago that they were having such problems and business was tanking. But then they started to see some signs of demand come back because people maybe needed to quarantine or people decided if I have to go somewhere, I don't want to be around other people. Maybe I just want to be in an empty house. So they would go and move to like an empty house in the middle of nowhere. And that was an Airbnb. So it got very bad and the company had to lay people off and they had to kind of change their focus. But then, you know, travelers are going to travel and they started slowly, but it's been mounting ever since.
Hannah Sampson, reporter for The Washington Post, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, like Airbnb, craft beer has a cool reputation, but in reality, it's often rough being a woman in that industry. We'll talk about how Me Too has come for the craft beer world next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, there have been lots of allegations of sexism, of harassment, and of generally toxic work environments leveled against the craft beer industry. And as in other industries that have faced Me Too moments, a few claims made by women quickly turned into hundreds, followed by some resignations and some work stoppages. One of the most high-profile reckonings happened right here in Southern California. The founder and CEO of San Diego-based Modern Times stepped down last month after allegations he didn't take harassment claims seriously. Craft beer is an overwhelmingly male and white industry. Just around 7% of brewers are women, nearly 90% white. Here to talk about all this is Melissa Hidalgo. She writes the Dr. Beer Butch column for LA Taco. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you, Madeline. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. Well, let's talk about how this all started. What shone the light, if you will, on this situation of, sexual harassment? And what are some of the claims?
You know, we can kind of mark the official start date to this particular moment to May 11th, so just a few weeks ago. And what happened was a head brewer at a brewery out in Salem, Massachusetts, her name is Brianne Allen, and she works for Notch Brewing. You know, she tells her own story about how, you know, for over a year and a half, you know, we know that bars and breweries were closed to customers. She didn't have to deal with any of this for a year. A lot of people didn't have to deal with any of the harassment until she goes back to work after the pandemic. At that point, when Brianne goes back to work at her brewery, her first day back on the job is when she started reporting harassment, and generally from the men in the building who were questioning her place there, who were questioning why she was even there to begin with, without even realizing that this woman is the head brewer and this is her workplace. In her words, that day just kind of really got to her because it wasn't just one comment, it was two or three comments in one day. So she goes home, posts on her Instagram account, just sort of offhand, off the cuff, what other women, who else has experienced sexist comments in the beer industry? Well, unbeknownst to her, that seemingly simple question turned out a whole flood of responses, as we can imagine, primarily by women. You know, the number I read somewhere anywhere between 800, I think, within like a 24 to 48 hour period. Of stories primarily by women in the brew industry, in the craft beer industry, and also like craft beer bars, areas that kind of serve craft beer. You know, everything running the gamut from what we might call microaggressions to sexist comments, all the way to rape and sexual assault. And these stories were coming in from all over, not just the US and primarily the East Coast and bars in the Midwest. It went abroad. You know, people in the UK were responding. People in Canada were responding. So we see now that, you know, the sort of larger culture of misogyny, of racism, of sexism, of really anti-feminine, because even though most of the respondents were cis women, there were some men who you know, were assaulted by other men for not being manly enough, for not being able to lift enough. So it's harassment, it's sexism, it's misogyny that we're seeing kind of coming to the head now. In this industry that likes to purport itself as being progressive, right, as being independent, as doing something different, you know, than the mainstream.
Well, also you have alcohol involved. So
absolutely.
That probably adds a lot to this situation.
It does. And of course, you know, and so it's not just craft beer in this sense. It's the alcohol industry. It's wine. Mm-hmm. We just saw a story in the LA Times not too long ago about a mayor in wine country whose own newspaper didn't hold him accountable for his raping and assaulting of women. So, you know, part of the stories are speaking against, you know, the alcohol in the establishments. Everybody from women who are working at breweries who don't feel safe on attending beer festivals, you know, doing their jobs at beer festivals because dudes are getting drunk and touching them or hitting on them. And also by the customers, you know, a lot of these complaints and a lot of these accusations were actually levied against the consumer, right? People who go to bars and drink beer and that are inappropriately touching the servers or inappropriately making comments to the bartenders. And so that's also part of the culture, you know, that people in beer, and specifically women in beer, want to change and want to shift.
Well, right, because you have that cliche of the, like, the St. Pauli girl, right?
Absolutely.
Where you have this, you know, buxom, scantily clad woman serving beer. And that's kind of, you know, the cliched image that probably is attractive to a lot of guys.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think what's interesting is when you actually start doing some research and listening to women in beer, you know, we start to learn the history that women were making beer from way back in the day. You know, women were the primary beer brewers. And it wasn't until, like most things, the rise of capitalism, the rise of sort of commercial beer, where beer, the industry, becomes now predominantly run by men. So anytime there's a profit to be made, right, it's, oh, men are in charge and we can do this better. And at the same time, when in the 80s and 90s, a lot of these microbreweries were kind of founded, it was very much an old white guy's club, you know, guys with beards, right? Mm-hmm. And that persists to this day. You know, I think what a lot of the women who I've talked to and heard discussing is that a customer will come into a craft brew bar, will see a woman behind the counter, and will look around for the guy with the beard, right? Because the guy with the beard must know something better, you know, than the woman who's running the bar behind. So that's why a lot of these stories are kind of similar kind of themes around not just harassment by customers, but the fact that the owners and the guys in charge of the bar, the brewery, are kind of permitting that kind of culture to go unchecked.
Right, of course. Well, so now there was a reaction to all of these Instagram posts and all of the accusations, and the CEO of Modern Times Brewery, that's a pretty big brewery.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of people have heard of it, that he resigned.
Yes.
Are you surprised by that?
No. I mean, you know, to be honest, okay, I'll say I'm surprised by the fact that, you know, that he actually did step down, and that Modern Times, I think, is probably the most high profile here in California. It's a San Diego brewery, but we, you know, there's one in Los Angeles, in downtown LA. There's many people have been to that tasting room, and there's also one up in Oakland. But I'll say, like, I wasn't surprised that this stuff was happening, right? Like, I was not surprised to hear of this culture. You know, as far as sort of there's the LA scene, and, you know, the LA breweries, at least from what I know and based on my research and what I've talked to, there's not been any LA breweries that have been named or any kind of reports aimed at certain LA breweries, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening, right? So a lot of the sort of stuff that's happening in LA right now with breweries is a lot of the preemptive work, you know, providing resources for employees and women who work in the industry, providing ways to complain or to submit a complaint so that an HR group can handle that complaint in a way.
So as we saw in other industries, a big reckoning, changes in corporate rules and allowed behavior. Do you think that's going to happen in this industry too?
Yeah, you know, in some ways it already started happening before this kind of broke out. As far as, you know, we can point to last year's Black Lives Matter movement, where you saw a lot of breweries suddenly kind of, you know, making their statements of solidarity, brewing beers to support organizations. This time around, you know, my sense is that we're not going to see some of the performative activism that we might see, because I think people are really, you know, they're really wanting to lay some groundwork for actual steps to be taken in order to change the culture. So that includes, you know, the beer guilds are not professional organizations in the sense that, you know, they don't handle HR. They're nonprofit organizations that are there for education and to promote beer. So now the beer guild is having to become kind of a clearinghouse for resources of how to respond to sexual harassment in the workplace, how to report harassment, because the sense is that a lot of people are still fearful, right? Fearful for their jobs, fearful for their reputations. Oh, I don't want to report so-and-so because he's a friend of a friend. And so a lot of it is just kind of changing that notion of, like, you know, why should we be afraid to report harm?
Melissa Hidalgo writes the Dr. Beer Butch column for LA Taco. Melissa, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. It was a pleasure being here again.
And that's it for us today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.